Law's Cool Podcast number 5.
Hi, I'm Jacob Kaufman. I'm a 1L here at Western.
And my name is Omar Haredi. I'm also a first-year law student at the University of Western Ontario. So we had a contest recently here on Law is Cool giving away free Blue Jay tickets for individuals willing to answer a minor skill testing question.
And the question is, what are the major differences between tort law and criminal law?
And we had a number of responses from universities in Toronto and London primarily, and we're going to listen into some of the audio comments that we got from the University of Western Ontario.
Let's roll the tape.
Okay, my name is Dave McKenna. Tort law deals with a civil or private wrong. So basically, if somebody does something to you, it's not a criminal offense. You want to take them to court, you want to get your damages, whatever, they ripped you off, they sold you something bad, you want to take them to court. Criminal law deals with if you make an infraction of the criminal code, so if you kill somebody, if you assault somebody, something like that. Crown prosecutes. In the case of tort law, it is one person, one private party prosecuting another private party.
Chris Boyko, tort law deals with personal matters between two parties, not subject to statutes of the Crown. In the interest of public good, tort law is more dealing with the interest of personal good.
Hi, I'm Dana Lord. One of the differences between criminal and tort law is that offenses in criminal law are breaches of obligations to the society, whereas in tort law, it is a private problem, and it is a breach to a private obligation.
My name is Will, and the difference between tort law and criminal law is that tort law is more of a private matter, whereas criminal is more falls in the public domain.
Well, those are good answers.
Yeah, I think they cover about most of the bases.
Yeah. Interesting, I was a history major before, and historically, as we learned in class, there was no difference between tort and criminal, and that you would have to enforce the criminal sanction from a private individual. Private people for murder would take them, and you would get a monetary award, a blood price for someone who murdered or somebody who criminally assaulted you. And as we learned in class today, that actually continued even up to the 1850s.
Exactly.
In the United Kingdom. You, private individuals responsible for apprehending and for prosecuting criminals.
Yep, and that's exactly why we asked that question, because they do have a common origin.
Yeah.
I think the only major issue that I think was overlooked was the imbalance of power which exists between criminal law and tort law.
I mean, two private parties are at some level on the same status, but in criminal, there's no comparison between the parties. One party has the entire resources of the state that is falling down on a single individual. So in those cases, you really have to set up safeguards for the individual, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Safeguards that you don't have in tort law. You just need a balance of probabilities.
Exactly, whereas in tort law, you never really know where the imbalance is going to fall prior to the case.
Yeah. Also, there's some cases where criminal and tort law will apply. If somebody assaults you, there can be a criminal trial for assault, but you can also have tort actions for battery.
Mm-hmm.
Because a tort for assault is different than the criminal definition of assault.
Exactly.
Assault is just creating the reasonable apprehension that a person will inflict force upon you,
mm-hmm.
or what you're wearing or riding in.
So, Jacob, I was talking to you earlier, and there was a specific criminal case that you had some interesting thoughts on, right?
Yeah, it's Canadian Foundation for Children, Youth, and the Law, and Canada. And, as a first-year law student with about a month in, I'm kind of making a claim, I guess, the vast majority of the Supreme Court is wrong in this case, because I'm smarter than these people who, brilliant and have devoted their entire lives to the law. But it's a lopsided majority. You have 6-1, and I think the dissent is right. Basically, it's concerning Section 43 of the Criminal Code, which allows under some circumstances, the use of force by way of correction towards a pupil or child, if it doesn't exceed what's reasonable under the circumstances. And the court was asked to consider whether this was a reasonable statute or whether it should be struck down. And the court maintained it, and they kept it. They just modified it in certain ways. They said you can't corporally punish children under 2, children over 12. You can't use objects. You can't hit them on the head. Teachers can use force to remove students from classrooms, not to punish. It's a very reasonable set of rules. And were the court the House of Commons, it would be an excellent decision on their part. But they are, in fact, not the House of Commons. It's interesting how much the court has to contort itself to reach this decision, as Arbour states. It's useful to note how much work must go into making the provisions constitutionally sound and sufficiently precise. The word child must be construed as to include children only over age 2 and younger than teenage years. Parts of the body must be excluded. Implements must be prohibited. The nature of the offense calling for correction is deemed not a relevant contextual consideration. Teachers are prohibited from utilizing corporal punishment, and the use of force that causes injury that is neither transient nor trifling is prohibited. And as she concludes, at a certain point, mere interpretation ends and an entirely new provision is drafted. And it's not the role of the court to draft new precision. In fact, there's several reasons for this. As the justices said in Malmo, Levine, and Kane, that the precise weighing and calculation of the nature and extent of the harm is Parliament's job. Members of Parliament are elected to make these sorts of decisions and have access to a broader range of information, more points of view, and a more flexible investigative process than the courts do. And this is every single justice who stated that is in the decision that we were talking about earlier.
Uh-huh.
You know, the court could have said, look, there are problems constitutionally with Section 43. We want you to examine it. Point is, Parliament has the ability to find this far more than just relying on which experts are called in a trial. And when courts decide to interpret, pass the point of interpretation, and create entirely new laws, even if those laws are excellent laws, I just consider that to be a problem.
Okay.
Of course, they're Supreme Court justices, and I'm not.
Maybe we can change that one day, right, Jake?
I don't speak French, so I'll have to learn.
Well, thanks for your thoughts on that, and I think we're going to wrap up for this episode.
Okay,
hopefully you guys tune in next time.
Yeah.